For more than a year and a half, we've been remembering some of the nearly 800,000 people who've died of COVID-19 in the U.S., and we've asked you to share their stories with us.
Today, we're remembering the Reverend Irvin Doyle Turner, Natomishkong, the one who goes before his people. He belonged to the Anishinaabe people of the White Earth Nation.
My father meant so many things to me, a hero figure. He was a friend. He was a guide to me as I moved through life. I always looked to him and valued his opinion. He parented in a really interesting way where he kind of let me find my way.
And he made himself available. If somebody needed something, he answered that call tirelessly. The gospel was an important part of who he was. Serving the wider community, both as a priest and as a chairman, that was the arc of his life.
Those are his sons, Doyle and Stephen Turner. The Turner family lived on the White Earth Nation Reservation until the early 80s, when the entire family packed their lives up to move to Chicago while Reverend Turner attended seminary school. And then, though it's unusual for the Episcopal Church to send priests they've recently trained back to their home communities, the family returned to Minnesota.
One of the really most beautiful parts of his ministry was they sent him back to the White Earth Reservation to serve the four churches there. And so he got to live his life serving the people that he knew and had grown up with.
Turner's sons say their father taught them everything, and that his passing affects them deeply because he connected the family to the land and Ojibwe culture.
My dad taught us both to be hunters. And so when we go out hunting, we walk the land that my great-grandpa hunted. We've got the connection to the land through all of these stories. And that's one of our major losses with Dad, is he was our story carrier. That's gone now.
According to his sons, Turner found great peace in the woods and loved to eat wild rice, fresh walleye, venison, and pancakes with peanut butter and maple syrup he harvested himself.
His death was sudden. His sons say their father developed a nagging cough, and that while watching a football game on Sunday, September 12th, Turner struggled through halftime before retiring upstairs for a nap. When he woke up, he has to be taken to the ER, where the family's worst fears were realized. He was diagnosed with COVID-19, even though he was fully vaccinated.
He said to me in the ER, he said, "I just want to put my back up against a tree, because it's the woods."
Reverend Irvin Doyle Turner was 77 years old when he died of COVID-19 at home on Tuesday, September 14th, 2021.
Many years ago in days of childhood.
And if you'd like us to memorialize a loved one you have lost to COVID-19, find us on Twitter at NPRATC. There's a pinned tweet at the top of the page.
Then winding down an old familiar pathway, I'd hear my mother call.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Procter & Gamble, maker of Align Probiotic, a daily supplement to support digestive health, containing a probiotic strain developed by gastroenterologists with 20 years of research. More at alignprobiotics.com. And from C3 AI. C3 AI software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable problems. C3 AI. This is Enterprise AI.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Long after a bout with COVID-19, many people still struggle with memory problems, mental fog, and mood changes. One reason is that the disease can cause long-term injuries to the brain. NPR's John Hamilton reports on what scientists are learning about how these injuries occur.
When COVID-19 arrived in the U.S., a team of scientists on the West Coast began studying the disease in monkeys. John Morrison directs the California National Primate Research Center. He says at first, the team focused on the animals' bodies.
Obviously, to look primarily at the lungs and other peripheral tissues.
But Morrison, a neurology professor at UC Davis, wondered whether the virus was also reaching another area.
Early on, I said, let's take the brains. So we have this collection of brains from these various experiments, and we've just started to look at them.
Morrison presented some early results of that research at the Society for Neuroscience meeting in November. And one finding stood out.
It's very clear in our monkey model that neurons are infected.
Neurons are the brain cells that make thinking possible. But studies of human brains have produced conflicting evidence on whether they are being infected by the virus. Morrison says that may be because researchers haven't looked closely enough.
We're looking at individual neurons at very high resolution, so we can see evidence of infection in individual neurons.
Especially in older monkeys with diabetes. The infection appeared to start with neurons connected to the nose. But Morrison says within a week, the virus had spread to other areas in the brain.
This is where you get into some of the neurologic symptoms that we see in humans of cognitive issues, brain fog, memory issues, changes in mood. Because by then, I suspect that the virus is in the regions that mediate those behaviors.
That hasn't been confirmed in people. But other researchers have found evidence that the virus can infect human brain cells. Heidi Serrano of the Banner Sun Health Research Institute in Arizona led a study of 20 people who died with COVID-19. The brains from four of them showed signs of infection. And Serrano says that, just like with monkeys, the virus seemed to have entered through the nose.
There's a nerve that is located right on top of your nose that is called the olfactory bulb.
Serrano says the virus appears to be killing nerve cells in this area of the brain, which may explain why many COVID patients lose their sense of smell and some never regain it. In other brain areas, though, the team found less evidence of infection. That could mean that the virus is injuring those areas indirectly. For example, the virus appears to infect the cells that line blood vessels in the brain. Serrano says the immune system's reaction to this infection could inadvertently kill neurons in the area and impair a person's thinking.
Anything that affects the brain, any minor insult to the brain could be significant in cognition.
COVID-19 can also damage the brain by causing a stroke. It can break down something called the blood-brain barrier, which protects brain cells from harmful substances, including viruses. And it can damage the lungs so badly that the brain is starved for oxygen. Dr. Jennifer Frontera of New York University says these indirect effects appear to be a much bigger problem than any direct infection of neurons.
People have seen the virus inside of brain tissue. However, the viral particles in the brain tissue are not next to where there's brain injury or damage.
That may be because the virus has already been cleared from that tissue. In any case, Frontera says COVID-19 presents a major threat to the brain. She was part of a team that studied older COVID patients in the hospital and measured levels of toxic substances associated with Alzheimer's and other brain diseases.
When we looked at those, the levels were really high, higher than what we see in patients that have Alzheimer's disease. So indicating a very severe level of brain injury that's happening at that time.
And it's an injury that many scientists fear might lead to Alzheimer's. Frontera says even COVID-19 patients with severe brain problems tend to improve over time. She was part of a study that measured mental function 6 and 12 months after a hospital stay.
Patients did have improvement in their cognitive scores, which is really encouraging.
Half of the patients, though, still weren't back to normal. So Frontera says now scientists need to find treatments that can help these people recover. John Hamilton, NPR News.
From photographs documenting the AIDS crisis to a series of Afrofuturist self-portraits, Lola Flash's work challenges invisibility, preconceptions, and stereotypes. This evening, the LGBTQ arts organization Queer Art will honor Flash with an award for sustained achievement. Allison McCabe has her story.
Agnes Gunn, Esther Cooper Jackson, Ruth Pointer.
These are just a few of the women who appear in Lola Flash's portrait series, Salt. They're all over 70, still actively engaged in their life's work.
When we get older, we aren't seen. Up until the age of, I would say, 25 or 26, we're all, you know, like the it girls, right? And then after you sort of pass over this threshold of maybe 30, 35, you're put out to pasture.
Flash has been taking pictures since childhood.
I was a bit of a loner. I was an only child. And so I was playing around with this wonderful little Minox camera, sometimes taking pictures of my fish tanks. I was not at all aware of the power of photography.
But after college, Flash moved to New York City. It was the late 1980s, the height of the AIDS crisis. She started going to ACT UP demonstrations and taking pictures, developing the film on negative paper, a process which reversed the colors and altered the viewer's perspective.
It made a beautiful Kodak day look like a crazy storm was about to start. You know, the clouds become black. The cool color of the sky becomes this really crazy red, warm color that just looks like everything's on fire.
In the 1990s, Flash started taking large format portraits. She photographed trailblazers, elders, and those whose skin color or gender expression rendered them invisible or pushed them to the margins. Katie Pebenito is one of Flash's models.
I recently found a love for myself through Lola's photography. I'm like no longer afraid of the way that I see myself.
At first, Flash showed her photographs in restaurants and pubs. Then galleries and museums caught on. Today, the images appear on the walls of institutions such as New York's Museum of Modern Art and London's Victoria and Albert Museum. But cultural theorist Karen Jaime still sees Flash's work as community-based.
I want to center her as a queer Black Indigenous artist who's creating this work that's actually giving us a blueprint for queer survival. She's really committed to highlighting the contributions and the presence of marginalized people, not just having you see them, but also recognize that this is a legacy.
Flash's current portrait series is called Syzygy, The Vision. At times, the artist transforms herself into an avatar subjected to the horrors of racism, sexism, and homophobia. Other times, she is seen experiencing moments of joy, envisioning a future where there's equity for all.
In as much as this is a specific series, the series also reflects and represents a thread throughout her work. Her photography and activism are profoundly connected, fueling a lifelong commitment to visibility and preserving the legacy of the LGBTQIA plus and communities of color worldwide.
That's Halima Taha, who advises institutions and private collectors on the acquisition of visual work by Black artists. She says Flash's photography has particular value for future generations.
They will have a lot of information about people who have made major and significant contributions.
Tonight, it's Flash's turn to be celebrated. Tomorrow, you'll find her teaching visual arts to 9th and 10th graders in Brooklyn.
I often say that, you know, if you don't have a legacy, then you can be that person. You can start it.
For NPR News, I'm Allison McCabe.